So I'm Jeffrey Higgins. Welcome to Elaine's and Elaine's Literary Salon. Thank you all so much for coming. I gotta tell you, this means a lot to me that you come out for my book. I've interviewed 176 authors leading up to today. And so it's weird to be on the other side of it, but I really appreciate it. And I know why the authors get so excited. Writing is so solitary, and having friends and family and colleagues and come out and support work really means a lot to me. So Chris Chambers is interviewing me today. Better be
yes,
good, Chris.
Yes.
All right, Christopher Chambers is a Seamus and Anthony nominated crime fiction and graphic novel author. He's a native of Washington, D.C., and yet proud former resident of Baltimore. Random House publishes first hardcover thrillers, Sympathy for the Devil and A Prayer for Deliverance in 2003. His short stories appeared in major anthologies, including the Anthony Award-winning The Obama Inheritance. He's a contributor to Marvel's The Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, and Sam Wilson, The Shield of Captain America. Three Rooms Press publishes DC hard-boiled noir trilogy, Scavenger, Standalone, and Streetwise. I interviewed Chris about Streetwise. It was fantastic, by the way. His voice is really wonderful. He's on the board of the BoucherCon World Mystery Conference and is president of Mystery Writers of America's Middle Atlantic Chapter. Publishers Weekly called Chris No Holds Barred, and The Strand magazine calls Chris the modern heir to Chandler, Woolrich, and Kane. You can view his podcast, Chris Chambers Noir, on YouTube and listen on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Incandescent Radio. Speaking of which, you can find our podcasts on elainesliterarysalon.com. We just hit number one on Spotify for literary podcasts.
Yay.
And we're number three on Apple, so keep those coming. But it's really a lot of fun. And if you're an author, we offer free space for authors, so please reach out to me, Jeffrey at jeffreyjameshiggins.com, and let's find a time to get you in here so we can celebrate your work as well. Did I miss anything, Chris?
No, I think that covered it. We can eat and drink.
So we're out of time, so thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.
Well, I just want to do an icebreaker now based on, you know, an older book that you did, Forever Game. It had talked about AI, if I'm not mistaken. And I happened upon an article that said that there was a publisher that was using AI to summarize manuscripts coming in. And you know, totally taking the human aspect out of it. And, you know, I mean, as an icebreaker, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, is that something that you didn't really touch on specifically in Forever Game? I mean, but you did deal with the duality of this technology, which was kind of new and scary back then, but now it's just pervasive. And some say being shoved down our throats. I mean, in our business, the thought of a publisher saying, you know, even not even giving it to an intern, which is aggravating as it is, having a 22-year-old tell you what to do, but that person's still a human being. That person's still a training in publishing, in writing, et cetera. I mean, what do you think about that?
So I sat here 3 years ago and had an argument with somebody, like right here at this table, where he was saying that, you know, AI is not going to change our lives and it's all overblown and it's really not, nothing's going to happen, not really understanding how transformational it would be. So I wrote that book, The Forever Game, which is based on real technology. A friend of mine who's the CEO of an AI company was telling me about another CEO of an AI company in Silicon Valley was downloading consciousness. And I'm like, we don't even know what that is. How is that even possible? You know, but it was a way to preserve and prolong life post-death of the human substrate. So that's what drove that book. But I mean, now we're even seeing, like, writers are notorious for not wanting to adapt to AI or any kind of technology, right?
Right.
And so I think what you're going to see, and I'll make a prediction, I think you're going to see the role of agent vastly diminished. And I think you're going to see a lot of publishers also cut massive amounts of staffing because a lot of the role that agents previously played, I mean, a lot of it's personal relationships, which can't be replicated. So that will remain. But the finding the right places, you know, looking at the data, doing the research, all of that can be done now by AI. Not as well, but give it a year. So I think we're going to see a sea change in the publishing business.
Well, the excuse, if you want to call it excuse, the explanation now is, well, all it's doing is just summarizing for us, you know. But you do lose that human touch when someone summarizes something and then goes to their, you know, superior and say, you know, I really like this. I think that there's an angle here. There's a feeling here. There's a theme here that we really need to hit on. And you know, and a cold machine, I'm using the word machine very loosely, can it be trained to do that? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, we could take bets on that. That'll be your fifth, you know, Burke book.
So I had an ethicist in here who works for the Department of Defense, and he deals with weapons and the ethical consequences of AI. And I've thought a lot about some of these issues. So I asked him some kind of penetrating questions about this, and he scared the heck out of me because his answer to almost everything was, I don't know. You know, and this was the guy, right? And I mean, so I think the good news is I'm an Authors Guild ambassador, and Authors Guild has a human generated, I forget, I should probably remember the phrase, but they actually have a button you can get as a human author that you can put on your work. And I recommend that because AI will become indistinguishable, I think, from human authors. And you probably see that now when you get an email, and it's getting harder and harder to tell, right? If it's AI or a person. I get calls here at the restaurant, and they're AI, you know, and then they add the ums and the uhs, and like it's still very primitive, right? But it won't be in a very short amount of time. It'll be impossible to distinguish. But the good news is, you as a human being will always know how to feel, and the AI really can't. It can only parrot and mimic, right? So there will always be a role for human authors.
Okay.
But that's not what my series is.
Right, I know. Well, before we get to the Uganda Protocol, I was wondering if you could help educate us. You know, in our general genre, you know, we have silos. I mean, publishers, agents like to put us in silos. Like,
can you hold that a little closer?
Like, you know, domestic suspense versus hard-boiled noir, national security thrillers versus cozies, etc. In your line of work, I mean, in Nathan Burke's line of work, what are the silos, and are they silos, or are they really membranes? I mean, let's say, because this is central to the type of writing that you do. The CIA versus the FBI, you know, where does one end and the other begin? Is it a wall or is it a membrane? Or the DEA versus the FBI, or international stuff versus primarily local law enforcement? I mean, are there walls? Because that is something that's important to your writing. I just wanted to just initially see, you know, what the explanation is there.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually love your analogy. Because, like, in thrillers, right, there's, like, some people put crime above thrillers, or is crime a subgenre of thriller? And then within that, you have all these subgenres. I think there's, like, 27 or 30
exactly.
Subgenres of thriller. But really, what anybody writes anything, and all the writers, there's a lot of writers in here, know when you write one thing, it hits a bunch of different subgenres, you know? So, like, when you're selling it, it's this old model of, in the bookstore, where do I shelve it? You know, what shelf does it primarily go on? And that's still a thing, a little bit. But with like Amazon, places, you know, some of these big online bookstores, it's in all the shelves, you know, so you can just find it. But for the real world, like law enforcement intelligence, there's a difference between the agencies in what they're congressionally allowed to do, like what their mandates are. But there's a lot of overlap. And so like for instance, you mentioned DEA and the FBI, they can both do drug cases. The DEA is a single mission agency, but it's also an intelligence agency. So, you know, if it's drug related, they're still working on it. And they're still creating all kinds of intelligence that isn't even drug related and then passing it to the appropriate agency. And the FBI is more, you know, it's domestic, and CIA is intelligence, and it's foreign intelligence. You know, in theory, I think we've seen
theory,
that it doesn't
yes,
necessarily
right.
work. But there's a lot of bleed over between it. But that stovepiping of information, right? Things that lead to like 9/11s, and that difference in what the allowed activities are of these different things creates these bureaucracies. And there's interagency competition, and there's also, you know, it causes a lot of like collateral unanticipated problems. And that's sort of like a lot of what this whole series, like one of the underlying themes, is this man versus institution theme. And that comes from my career. You know, that comes from having bureaucracy being as much of an enemy as a terrorist I was chasing.
Okay, so the next question there is, why in American thrillers in this genre, if you want to call, you know, we'll just keep it simple, call it a genre, there doesn't seem to be there seems to be a lot of this stovepipe and conflict situation. But if you look at, say, British writers, I mean, McCarran, John le Carré, I mean, it's like MI5 does this, MI6 does that. Now, is that just because that's how the writing and the entertainment world has left it out, or, you know, has unfolded it, or like there's the show on Apple TV, Slow Horses, starring Gary Oldman, for example. There doesn't seem to be that kind of fighting, you know, between MI5 and MI6 that you see in the entertainment part. I'm not talking about the real world. I'm talking about our world, the not so real world. There doesn't seem to be that infighting and stovepiping in their literature about this stuff as there is in ours. Why is that? I mean, unless I'm talking, I don't know what I'm talking about, but the man here can correct me if I'm wrong.
So the short answer is I have no idea.
Okay.
I did work with MI5. I worked with MI6 overseas. I've actually interviewed a British intelligence officer here, you know, so I probably should have a better visibility on this. But I mean, one of the things is we're a much bigger country. We have a lot more law enforcement agencies. There's a lot of overlapping jurisdiction. There's a lot of overlapping mission. It's a little more clear cut there. And I think part of the reason you see it in American thriller fiction is just that it's a real problem. Like, I mean, honestly, I used to, when I worked in New York, I used to carry a little yellow handkerchief in my pocket, and I'd throw it at some of the administrative people when they got in my way and call a penalty on the play. I'd be like, interference, that's 15 yards, you know, because it was the bureaucracy that stopped me from doing so much, or tried to stop me. You'll notice in my books, my agent bends the rules a little bit.
Yes,
you know,
we're going to get into that.
but that's the thing. Like I can honestly say the biggest cases I did, the stuff that I won the most awards for, the stuff that had the most impact, I did it in many ways in spite of the agency, in spite of the bureaucracy, I should say.
Well, let's go to the Uganda Protocol. What sets that apart from the other Nathan Burke books? I try to say that five times fast. I mean, because the only thing that I could see was that, without being no spoiler alerts here, but there seemed to be a definable human antagonist in this one versus the other three. You know, but is that fair to say, with Omar Yemeni being the antagonist?
So he comes in from another book, a previous book.
Right.
There are human antagonists in all the books, because honestly, if you talk about something in the abstract, it really doesn't resonate.
Well, I meant somebody really, like a really defined, concentrated, this person following him from cover to cover, kind of antagonist, that kind of person.
Yeah, so he's
Nemesis. How about that? Is that better?
I like it. It's much
better. Okay, yes, yeah. Nemesis.
That's coming from the noir writer.
Yes.
That's the Nemesis.
Yes.
Yeah, no, so he's chasing a fugitive in this one, and it's a fugitive from earlier in the series. In some of the other books, we're not sure, because these are conspiracies he's trying to unravel. So in the other books, you're not sure who the enemy is necessarily. And then the picture comes into focus as we move forward, which is part of it. And each one's about a different theme, you know. So the first one's the Havana Syndrome, which, by the way, is coming true all the time. Like there's breaking constantly, the stuff I wrote in there.
And that's not necessarily about Cuba. That's the directed energy stuff, yeah.
Right,
so
which
you
the
all
government
know.
Denied for a very, very long time.
Right.
And then there's the Khorasan Retribution, the Khorasan being like the Afghan-Pakistan region. And it's about a Foreign Service national who was left behind when we pulled out. And I actually dealt with 67 of those Foreign Service nationals I was trying to get out of Afghanistan. So I know what that's like very intimately. And then there's the China Gambit, which deals with Chinese disintegration warfare and unrestricted warfare, which is a very real set of strategies that China's using against the United States. And they're not hiding it. Like, they openly talk about it and have written books about it. So, and then this one, the Uganda Protocol, It brings, I don't want to spoil any of it, but it brings in other elements, but it's also a fugitive hunt, which I did a lot of.
Well, did you feel that this was the time for Nathan Burke to do that? And that's why I've focused on this, you know, kind of real, kind of tangible Nemesis thing. I mean, were you know, because you could have had the fourth book really follow this kind of shadowy kind of thing, just like the other three. Why did you want to do it this way, do it differently for this one?
So the China Gambit was a big international thriller. It's pretty complicated. A political thriller has a lot of different threads in it.
Right.
So I wanted to give the reader something that was slightly different. You know, still has some of the threads from the previous books, but it wasn't as complicated. And also, I've had a lot of ideas. Like this one, the reason the Uganda Protocol is I knew these two scientists, and they both worked in Africa, and they were telling me about their jungle labs and some of the things they faced there. This is years ago, and I'm like, oh, I've got to write a book about this, you know? So I like to combine ideas in these books. So these were several different ideas I had that I put together for this one. Also, the business end of this is, you know, I was on a 6-month delivery schedule with my publisher.
Okay, so see, those are the stories we really want to hear, because that's what really drives.
So I had to write something, you know. So I just finished this really big conspiracy book, a couple in a row. And actually, the Corazon Retribution is a little less of that. I mean, it's still like, you know, infiltration and like a conspiracy with some twists and things. But yeah, so I sort of went back and forth between the conspiracy and something that's a little more straightforward.
Well, I mean, was it easier, and however you want to take that word, easier, to have this thread of a manhunt in it versus, you know, the much more layered stuff of the earlier three books? You know, where again, at that point, it's just, you know, person against person. I got to find this, you know, this fugitive who did X, Y, and Z. Again, not spoiling it. Was it easier to kind of to conceptualize that and set that up, or was it tougher? I mean, what was your thoughts on that?
So there's still like two different stories that are going on simultaneously with Leila Kabiri, the translator, the Iranian translator. So, you know, so those two things have to come together. So there's still layers of complexity to it.
Right.
But, you know, just like they say, you know, like writing like short, there's a lot of short story writers in here. It's harder to write short stories. It's harder to write short, you know?
Yes.
So if you have less complicated, like big political international conspiracies going on, then it does become more complicated, right? So you have to lean more into the personal motivations, and you have to create that tension and those stakes in different ways. So, you know, it's different. It's a little different, but I mean, it still has a lot of the same flavor as the other three books.
Well, let's go over the commonality then. I mean, you'd mentioned, their character, you always seem to have another story there, another human story going on. Is it fair to say that it usually involves a female who might have some involvement in the other story, and it's not just another layer, it's really intricate, but it usually involves maybe a woman who has some kind of bad problem, and it's intertwined with what Nathan Burke is trying to figure out. So there's a commonality there in the other three books with this one. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, book two, the Corazon Retribution, it was another male POV for the other side. But yeah, I love to write female characters. I think they're interesting. I like to read them. I write what I like to read.
And I don't mean to say damsel in distress. Don't F with me on that. That's not what I said. I said another story layer here, just in case anybody, you know, says, I don't mean damsel in distress. I mean somebody who has a parallel course in this. And tell us about that character. I mean, what was the translator? What was that an interesting foray into giving her like full form and everything, while also making her an integral part of the plot?
Yeah, I'm still stuck on your don't F with me. I can tell you're a podcaster. You're trying to keep our clean rating on Apple, right?
Exactly. But I also am noir, so I have to skirt that line.
Yeah, I mean, it's like foreign-born translators, I worked a lot with them. And it's really interesting when they come from places where you're dealing with, like, terrorism groups, because they have families back in their countries of origin, you know? So there's pressures on them that other people aren't experiencing. There's also the clash of cultures. You know, my wife's an immigrant. My family comes from immigrants, you know? So I'm really fascinated by that. Like adopting a new culture, you know, seeking a new culture, but still being from the other one. So it creates a lot of natural conflict in a lot of different ways, both internal and external.
What did you, bouncing back to Nathan Burke, because that's what everybody wants to hear about. Why in this series, did you make him an FBI agent? He could have been CIA. I mean, again, this goes back to my question, you know, about what the British do. I mean, they're either, you know, Mick Herron's book, they're MI5. You know, James Bond was MI6. You know, he was overseas, you know, killing people rather than on British soil killing people, which is MI5 does. So I'm oversimplifying, obviously, but trying to be fun about it. But where, you know, why an FBI agent? I mean, why not CIA?
So I was in federal law enforcement, you know, for 20 plus years. So I worked with the FBI a lot. I mean, I worked with CIA overseas. I guess the writer answer to that is the previous book that I'd written had a DEA agent.
Okay.
So I was just mixing it up. But also the FBI has a broader mandate, so they can do a lot of different cases and they can bounce them around. And I just wanted to write about a different character.
Well, yeah, and that's why I wanted to ask you about those silos, you know, or membranes earlier, because it does seem like what he does kind of bleeds into a lot of the other agencies where there is the stovepiping, but it gets kind of porous sometimes. But if you would wanted to take it in a different direction, you know, would you have made him a CIA agent back, you know, when you were back in the day when you were noodling out this stuff?
I mean, I have CIA agents in other books, you know, and so it's interesting too, but it's a different mission.
Okay.
You know, I like the FBI because, I mean, I worked with a lot of really talented FBI agents, really brave people, you know, doing an amazing job, but it's also this incredible bureaucracy. Like, it's so much worse than DEA. And I worked in counterterrorism work, but it was still so much worse. Like, I'll give you an example. After 9/11, I was one of the first people to get to the North Tower, and I went on the Joint Terrorism Task Force for, I don't know, a couple months, and using, like, drug enforcement tactics, I was able to identify the guy who drove the hijackers around in New Jersey, right? Like finding things, flipping people, you know, pressuring people, developing informants, like doing the thing that we do all the time, which is a very aggressive form of law enforcement. And then I found the guy's car, I found where he was living, and I was sitting on his car and I was working with the FBI, and I asked him, hey, let's get a bumper beeper, like it's a tracker, right, that we can just like magnetic thing we could slap on his car. And they were like, okay, so they had to go to their boss, put in a formal request, and then they had to go all the way up in enforcement to their special agent in charge, then over to the technical division, and then all the way back down to somebody who could issue the thing. And I'm like, I'm sitting on this guy's car, and I can't sit here forever, you know? So I just picked up the phone and called my office. I said, just put me in touch with the tech room. And I told the guy, I need this. And he's like, okay, it's on its way. Like, you know, and like that was literally, that wasn't really our policy or procedure either, but, you know, you can work around things.
Well, you know, where I'm going with this is that, you know, in my world, in terms of noir hard-boiled, I mean, the FBI, we usually kind of characterize them as either, you know, political hard-asses or just federal flatfoots. And, you know, that probably does, you know, yes, obviously puts them in silos, you know, but that's in my little subgenre. But it just seemed that, you know, when I was looking at Nathan Burke, there was this kind of anti-federal flatfoot kind of thing going on. And that's what I always ask people who use FBI agents as their protagonist, is that there is this notion that it is a very kind of suit and tie, flat foot kind of a job, bureaucratic kind of job, and it might need a little more, you know, glamming up and make it more exciting to put it in a thriller kind of a situation, unless it's counterterrorism or you're chasing a guy who's eating people. Okay, and, you know, and
this is a restaurant. Right,
yeah,
back
I know.
In.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm talking about Silence of the Lambs here. You know, so okay.
By the way, the lamb is on special.
Yes. But you all know what I'm talking about. But that's why I always find it fascinating when people like, you know, like you, Jeff, can synthesize that and make it relatable, but also so exciting.
Well, thanks, Chris. I mean, it's a real thing, right? And I try to write with authenticity. And I can tell you, like I'll give you an example that just to follow up on the one I was doing before. I was interrogating somebody. So it was a civilian in New Jersey who'd been dealing with the, he'd been protecting the guy, like he illegally hired him. He'd been subsidizing him. And he was driving, this was the guy who was driving the hijackers around, right? So we found this guy. So I have him in a room and I'm interviewing him, but he was lying and I knew he was lying. So I was pushing him kind of hard, you know, and catching him, trying to catch him in lies and letting him develop these like, this sort of maze of fabrications that he wouldn't be able to, you know, hold up over time. And in the middle, it was myself and my partner and two FBI agents. And in the middle of the interview, it wasn't an interrogation, it was an interview. In the middle of the interview, the FBI agents were saying something to each other. They got up and walked out. So I told my partner, I said, go see what's going on. So he goes out with them. So now I'm just talking to this guy myself. And I flip him, and I get the information that we needed, and he confesses to everything. And my partner comes back in, and so we finish the interview, we get the information, and I walk out. I go, what happened to those guys? He's like, they thought you were being too mean to him. Right? I mean, that's one thing. But then I also worked with like the hostage rescue team. I worked with them overseas. I did a lot of work with them. And these guys are kicking down doors and going after the worst of the worst.
Right.
I worked with their fly teams, which were guys who would fly to these conflict zones and just right in harm's way, you know, going out with Special Forces A teams to go after targets and to find evidence. So there's this huge spectrum of agents in the FBI.
Right. HRT. Yeah. That's like their SWAT, basically. Yeah. Well, let's going back to that, piggybacking on that story, did you have to do any kind of cleansing of your memory? You know, if you're an FBI, I'm sorry, if you're a CIA agent, I mean, we're talking about somebody like Alana Barry. I mean, you have to get clearance to write even a novel. Did you have to do anything official or anything unofficial?
So, like, I've talked to DEA about some of the things I was writing, and the guidance, it's different for just a pure intelligence agency as opposed to federal law enforcement, because everything I was doing, and we passed a ton of intelligence, right? We really changed the way people were looking at, like, the narco-terrorism and the drugs and terrorism nexus. But anything that we did, we were trying to do for a federal court. So, I'd extradite people and bring them to the U.S., and so everything sort of by definition was not classified. So I stay far away from the classified stuff.
Right.
If I had anything, if I was writing nonfiction, anything in that realm that was even close, I would absolutely get vetted. This is all fiction out of my mind.
Has anybody ever come to you at an event like this or just out on the street and said, hey, Jeff, in the Havana Syndrome, you wrote about X, Y, and Z, and that sounds a lot too close to what we were doing. I mean, anybody ever come to you and say, you know, you're coming a little too close to the line about some stuff we were doing?
No, but you just gave me a great novel idea.
That's where we aim to please. There's an interesting, because I was talking about Alana Barry. I asked Barry, award-winning author. You interviewed her here.
Yeah, by the way, shout out to her. Her. If you guys haven't read The Peacock and the Sparrow, oh my God, this is so good. I think they're making it a movie now.
Yeah, they are. They did, and it's not just an option thing. I mean, they have a showrunner and everything. And she blurbed my latest too. So I mean, you know, which has nothing to do with spies, you know. But it's interesting. She looks at this, you know, and she doesn't look at this writing as a catharsis, but you know, just telling a good story. Do you look at any of these novels, these Nathan Burke novels, and even stuff you did before, as catharsis or release, or either just creative release or getting rid of demons, like I do, or
I feel like you want to tell us something.
Yeah, I really do. The lamb was enough, though. Do you look at it that way, as a release, either creative release or cathartic mental release? How do you look at these?
I love to tell story, you know, so I look at that. Anytime I'm writing fiction, first draft is my favorite thing. Like, I just love it so much. So that is just pure joy for me, and it's fun. The stuff that what you're talking about is, like, writing about law enforcement or the intelligence and stuff, that stuff does not make me happy. Like, I honestly have a nonfiction book that I'm going to go back and work on a little bit. It's the story of really the first narco-terrorism case and from 9-11 to making the first arrest for narco-terrorism. But when I write that stuff, it just sort of makes me tense. You know what I mean? Because it's all life and death stuff. A lot of people I worked with were killed. You know, it's not really fun. What I really enjoy writing the most is psychological suspense.
Right.
These are fun too, right? Because I guess in a way it's cathartic in that I can talk about some of the problems, and I have a protagonist who's overcoming them.
Right.
But honestly, that's what I did for my whole career. You know, I had a reviewer say, "Oh, you know, the way they're breaking the rules and going out," and I was just thinking, "Yikes!" You know, like I never broke a law, but I would certainly stretch our procedure.
Right. Okay. Well, you don't have to admit it here on Apple Podcasts, but. Let's go to that process then. I mean, you know, you to say you're prolific is like a joke. I mean, an understatement. I mean, you have this process, and is it kind of I'm going to go with my gut, I'm going to go with the first draft and just roll kind of thing, and then come back. I mean, because your output is incredible, but there's no, you know, slacking in terms of quality. So, I mean, you know, now a lot of that, 99.9% of that is talent, obviously, but there's some kind of process in there. I mean, how does that work?
Tell me more about my talent.
Well, there's the 1%. I'm asking you about the 1% about process. I mean, what's the process? How do you keep that up?
You know, I've interviewed so many authors here and with my other podcasts and things and conferences, you know, hundreds and hundreds of authors. And I've been really focusing lately on, like, what makes them productive in writing habit. And I've talked to so many New York Times bestsellers and asked them these same questions, and writers who haven't yet started. And what I found is, you know, I mean, it sounds so trite, but it's like writers write. It's you can talk about it all you want, but in the end, you just have to write. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has that 10,000 hours to achieve mastery in any subject. It's like a million words for writers. And some writers write these brilliant things, I.S. Barry, right, with their first attempt. Others, like me, it takes longer to really get into it. But you just got to write. And so having said that, the key to doing that is developing habit. And there's a lot of science on this, you know, but that means just like you don't have to write every day. And some writers take off the weekends, some writers take off days, but every day that you're not writing, the story kind of drifts out of your conscious. And it takes longer when you sit back at the desk to like get the story back. Okay, what was I doing? Because these are complicated.
Right.
Especially if you're writing like a political international thriller, right? It's got so many different internal and external things happening. So what I found is I can tell too, right away. Because I'll tell people this, right? I counsel writers here. By the way, we're doing a Elaine's Writers Club here now. And we're just doing it as a way to bring writers together on all different levels so they can support each other, but also do some of these craft things. And we're offering a lot of seminars and you know, a lot of free content that would help people. But it's above all else, it's this developing habit. And it's if you don't, like I write every day. I come in here early before the staff arrives and I get as much writing in as I can. And then sometimes I'll do a second session or if my wife comes in the evening, I'll go home and I'll do more. But it's you know, whether you do a word count or you're just pushing yourself. And then the second piece of that, which just goes to your process, is it's getting through the first draft. And like to me, I see the story, you know, and so I have to run through it. And if I spend, it's like reading a book. If I take longer than a week to read a book, I start to lose interest. It's like that when I'm writing a book. Like I have to just race to the end. And so I'm an outliner. So I spend a few days at the beginning outlining and putting it in a 4X structure. But then I just write. And the nice thing is no one sees it until you give it to somebody, right? So when you get through that first one, if I spend like 2 months or 3 months writing the first draft, I've done them in 6 weeks and 7 weeks. But I mean, now with my schedule, it's usually about 3 months. I'll spend another 3 months editing, you know, so I spend a ton of time doing that. But it literally just is deciding, like, if you want to be a writer, and I believe this because I've just heard it from so many people, if you want to be a writer, you have to make it a priority in your life, right? So it means I love to watch, you know, Netflix. I'm watching, like, old Modern Family, right?
Right.
But that's, you know, 30 minutes I could be writing. So it's like at some point, don't give up your life just to write, but... It's if you can't find like an hour a day out of 24 hours, then you don't want it badly enough. And you know, and so I tell people that if you want to write, and if you can't find the time, and the big secret. I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but about this.
You're getting gems here. You know, because you could take a course, you know, on the technique, and you know, but you're getting the soul of it right here. Because that's the most important thing.
Sorry, I can tell you, I've probably written, over 1.5 million, or maybe 2 million words. But I play chess too, is I play speed chess. And what I notice is when you're playing speed chess, you're just seeing the patterns and you're just moving, right? You're just seeing it, you're making your moves, they're really fast, 3 second moves. And I just noticed that this week when I was editing, that I wasn't stopping to think about anything, I was just making the changes. Like it was just happening. And I felt just like I was playing speed chess, when I was going through and changing things. So the trap, which I was gonna say, is thinking I'm gonna wait till I retire, I'm gonna wait till the kids are gone, I'm gonna wait for this vacation this week. And what people do is they put all this pressure on themselves then when they have like that week off to try to get all this work done, and nobody can do that because it's really hard. It's the most writers I talk to, unless you're Dean Koontz who works these crazy hours, they average 4 to 5, like full-time writers, 4 to 5 hours of actual like creativity and production a day. And anything more than that is exhausting. Like it's really hard, right? So if you're working full time, which most of us are, because it's impossible to make money at writing,
right.
You can.
You are a restaurateur,
right? Yeah, right. But if you can find an hour a day, that's a book a year, And so if you can do 2 hours a day, that's 2 books a year,
exactly.
But you just have to kind of do it every day, or enough that you're making serious progress. And if you miss a day, it's just like working out. Like I was a distance runner, and I used to say, something's better than nothing. So I didn't feel like going. I had an injury. I was whatever. And I'm like, I'll go. I'd lie to myself. I'm going to go out and run like 2 miles. And I would just go. And then once I got out there and I warmed up, I would run the full thing, right? And that it's the same thing with writing. Like just get something down, because if you write a page, it's in your memory. You brought it from your subconscious into your conscious. Then when you leave and go about your day, it moves back in your subconscious and you're still solving problems. So we don't really know how this works, but it happens.
It happens.
So if you do that every day, you'll be taking notes, you'll be washing the dishes. I don't wash dishes, but if I was washing dishes, I would say, but you're doing something where your mind's wandering and the solution
with
will
me,
just
it's the shower or shaving. I could be like a
shaving.
Well, sometimes I do. I'm on my face, not on my head. I know that's something that you can't relate. Don't worry about that. But it's on your head. That is.
Yeah, we all followed you.
Yes. But it's I know, I'm just messing with Jeff. We gotta make it fun here for the audience. But I mean it's when you piggybacking on what you just said, jumping back to the genres and subgenres we're in, can you be a pantser and write a good national security, federal, law enforcement, espionage kind of thriller? I mean, can you be a pantser and do that? Is that possible?
Yeah, people do it and they're very successful. I mean, so I'm talking about like habit and just writing and just dedicating yourself, giving yourself, like making the commitment to do it. And then how you do it is different for everybody. I know people who pants who are brilliant writers. I interviewed David McCloskey here at Damascus Station. He's got a bunch of New York Times bestsellers. He's a pantser. And so the reason I'm not a pantser is because of you can go down the wrong path. Things aren't working.
Right.
When you're talking about like an international thriller with all these different threads, it's really hard to bring them together. So I asked him, how many words do you throw out? And in that, I think it was his last book, he threw out 40,000 words, and it's brutal. Like, that's just
absolutely. That's a novella right there.
Yeah. I mean, really. And I know writers who will write their whole book and then they'll be like, okay, that's not working. And they'll stop and they'll just start from the beginning on a fresh page and write again. So, yeah, you can pants. I mean, like, you'll hear all these different, like, processes that people use. And the one thing I'd say is just do what works for you, And that's also a double-edged sword, by the way, because people will say, I'm doing it this way, and this everyone's different, which is true. But if whatever you're doing isn't producing writing, it's not working, so try something else. And I'm always tweaking my process. I've learned to do certain things. I change, you evolve as a writer, right? You do things. Like, I pants more. Pants meaning a discovery writer. Like, I write a...
By the seat of your pants.
Yeah, I write like a four-act structure, act one, act two A, two B, and then act three, or act four. And then I will, but then within that, I'll have a bunch of scenes. But for probably every 5 scenes, I'll add 2 when I'm writing, And sometimes I'll diverge and write these other things. So I give myself more room now because I have the structure pretty ingrained in my head so I can do it. But at the beginning, I had to do a lot more outlining and be a lot more strict with my structure.
Let me ask you this then. From the China Gambit to the Uganda Protocol. How has Nathan Burke changed, and how have you changed? That's a dessert question, right?
That's right. So the characters always have to change, right? So they're at the beginning, they can either have like a misbelief, like StoryGrid calls it a misbelief. So, you know, they think they're looking for something, and they whatever it is they're doing is wrong, and it takes that moment of realization later for them to have that change. You know, Jessica Brody in Save the Cat writes a novel, talks about wants versus needs. You know, people are wanting something, but they really need something else. And those are two that you can have internal flaws or phobias or something that somebody also has to get over, some way that they're dissatisfied. You see that a lot too in sci-fi, you know, where somebody's dissatisfied with who they are or their position or what's going on, so they're looking to change that. So in these books, Nathan's, you know, he starts off with his wife's leaving him and he has a young child. So it's a lot of the family side of it. So I like to talk about the human side of what these like international plots do, because people forget about that, you know, because
they're people. Yeah.
I mean, they're people. Right. They have lives. And yeah. I mean, I spent like 10 years overseas, and like I'd come back, you know, for like once, you know, a few times a year, and I'd come back and it was like, I'd be like, what's a honey boo-boo? You know, like I would just like, you're so removed from the culture. You come back and it's shocking, you know, because the culture moves in a direction and you've been out of it. So, like, it definitely affects people's families. It affects how they view things or perception of things. And then the second part of that for me, you know, I become a better writer, I hope, because I try focus practice when I'm writing this stuff. So when I finish a manuscript and I go back and I look at it, I'm like, oh, my God, this is, you know, like, you're better with every draft that you write. Like I had a contract for a book, and I wrote a book in 2019. It's one of my favorite books. I really like it. It's my only actual pure mystery. And so I had a contract in like 2023, and in 2024, my agent told me to pull the contract. So I pulled it from the publisher, and then it sat there. So I rewrote it in like 23, I think. And so I just looked at it because I want to get the book back out. And I'm like, oh my God, like I'm changing almost every line. You know, that was just 3 years ago.
Wow.
It was probably like a million words ago, right, but it was three years ago, right?
Right.
And I thought it was, you know, so polished, and it had multiple contract offers,
right,
you know, and I had to change it. So that's how hopefully I'm a better writer at the end of everything.
Do you think you'll break off any characters? And I don't mean antagonists, you know, bad people characters, but someone like the you know, along the lines of the translator in the Uganda Protocol. I mean, somebody like that, would you ever see breaking off and starting a series with them?
Yeah, that would be fun, but I'm not going to do that. I mean, I have hundreds of ideas. I keep, like, you know, documents. I have hundreds of story
ideas.
And
we'll get to that.
I really want to go back to my psychological suspense.
Okay.
I've got three of them on my desktop. I have seven books sitting on my desktop. I just have to get back out. But I just have new ideas and things I want to work on. So I think it's important as a writer, too, to push yourself and try new things. You know, and like, so every book, like there's some new technique or there's some new location or different type of POV or whatever. I'm always trying to like add a tool to the kit.
Yeah, I was asking that because this last summer I was at a launch up in Baltimore that Laura Lippman did, and she had basically broken off one of her supporting characters and written a cozy around that. And a lot of her, you know, kind of drive to do that was just to do something different, not only with that character, but just you know exercise different kind of muscles. And I try to, you know, I think about that all the time, and I ask writers, you know, whether that's something that they would think about. I guess is it because you obviously have a lot of stuff? It's like Prince. I think when Prince died, I think they found like 800 albums worth of stuff just written on paper and in a box. So, but I mean, is it because you don't have characters that you would want to spin off like that, or you just have all this other content out there you want to get out first? I mean, or is it a combination of the two?
No, that's a good question, man. There's characters I really like in these books that could certainly do that. But, you know, I think you have to be really energized about whatever you write. Like, if I'm excited to tell a story, like, there's a call out now for a specific type of book. And
yeah.
I've been thinking about answering it. But if I'm not really energized, if I'm not excited and want to tell the story, then I think it'll fall flat, you know? So I just sort of am following whatever it is. Like when it comes time for the new book, and I'm looking at a few books right now, I go back to my ideas and I look at them and I figure, you know, which one resonates with me now, or maybe I combine a couple ideas. And when I find that one, I'm like, oh, I've got to tell this story, you know, regardless of market or what a publisher's looking for, that's what I do.
The next Nathan Burke book, I mean, is there a next one? What are you going to do?
I don't know if there is or not. I mean, we did four. It ended in a kind of nice place.
Yeah.
And each one's a standalone. So, like, you know, in the
And I'm sorry I didn't lead with that, that they can be read that way.
He has a broad arc across all four books, but, you know, each one's different subject matter. So, you know, I've had reviewers who say that's fine to start at the Uganda Protocol or whatever. I'd start at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
That's probably it, you know, but I'd be open to doing more in the future too. I mean, I have other stuff.
How many people want to see another Nathan Burke book? Yeah.
Oh, that's
true.
Taunting the audience.
Yeah, there's. what is on the front burner then for you, if you can, you know, give us a little taste?
So I've got several female in Jeopardy books. I love writing in first person too, by the way, you know. And so I have a few of those I want to get out. I have these seven books sitting at my desktop, and I don't know about the writers in here, but that drives me crazy. You know, I've written something, I'm proud of it, I like it, I want to get it out into the world. I just want people reading it, even if it's not a big success. I want people to read it. And then I'm in a couple of weeks, I should be done probably in about 10 days with the book I'm editing. I'm going to start something new. So I've got a bunch of ideas. I'm just trying to figure out which one I want to go with next.
Any,
which is fun.
Any ideas from current events? You know, we have a war and lines at airports and stuff like that. That's grist right there. Anything, you know, pulling in that you can pull into to a plot line?
I could do like a Tom Hanks, The Terminal, but you're just in line waiting for your flight.
that is prophecy right there. But that turned out well for him. I don't know about anybody traveling now, but what do you see in the future? I mean, I'm talking about the real world now in terms of this melding now of kind of law enforcement and international terrorism, narco-terrorism. I mean, everything's kind of coming together. I mean, do you see, is the future kind of bleak, or are we kind of keeping ahead of it, or... You know, can we do better to keep ahead of it? What do you see out there? I mean, in the real world again.
In the real world, terrorism is a real threat, right? And so, you know, Iran's been the number one sponsor of terrorism for my whole lifetime. I've been shot at by Iranian weapons. You know, I've seized Iranian weapons.
Right.
You know, so I mean, trying to reduce or minimize that threat. I mean, terrorism will never go away, right? People are politically, theologically, and ideologically motivated, so it'll always be there. But it's like murder. Murder doesn't go away, but you do the best you can to solve them.
But is money and position and information taking over from political or religious fervor, or is that always going to be there?
No, I think there's certain ideologies that are a huge threat to the country and will be, and you can't ignore them, right? I'm a big fan of taking people at their word.
Okay, yeah, you know? No, that's so true. If they tell you
what they want to do to you, you should listen.
You listen, yeah. do you think you'll be doing anything along the lines of nonfiction in that direction? I mean, you have all this content that you have, you know, saved up. I mean, is any of that nonfiction, and does any of that pertain to what's going on these days?
So I was thinking about two things. I have this book on the first narco-terrorism case. I do want to get that out. But
right.
I wrote it in 2017, so, oh, my God, I'm just dreading going back and editing that.
That wasn't so long ago. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah, but you're better after every book.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
if you write a 100,000-word book, like by the time you get to the end, you're just better. Like it never ends, by the way. So you can go through and edit it again, then go through again, and you're better. Like at some point, when I'm done, I can't look at it anymore, or the publisher says, send me the book.
Right.
Right. Those are the two things.
Usually it's the latter. It's like, you know, I need that email Friday, you know, that kind of a thing. Well, just really quick, going back to process. I mean, so with this first draft approach, I mean, is it like that movie Finding Forrester, where, you know, I think he said write the first draft with your heart in the second draft with your head? I mean, is that that hard charge and you get it down and then you roll back? Or do you ever try to pull to kind of edit as you go, even in that first draft?
Now, if I see I'm doing something wrong, I'll fix it as I'm going, or I'll make a note to go back and fix it. But the goal, like when I'm first drafting, it's, it used to be 2,000 words a day, now it's 1,000 words a day, but which is not that much. It's a few pages, you
right.
know? But it's like, I just try to keep going. And, you know, if I know something is wrong with a character or motivation or something, I'll take a beat and I'll try to fix it, and then I'll just write it going forward, and I'll know I'll have to go back and fix. But, like, writing with your heart, I get that. I mean, it's, I outline, so I have a good structure to begin with. And then sometimes I'll come up with new subplots, or, you know, some motivations will get stronger as the characters develop in the books. But I will go back later. That's when the editing's when you go back. Like, I used to actually have a hat, and I would say, this is my editor's hat. I would literally put on a hat just to, like, psychologically change. Like, that's not my work anymore. Now I'm the editor. I have to go back and tear this to shreds, you know? And so I still do that.
That's nice. Yeah. I got to think about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, because the one time you're writing, right? And also, you know, as you're going through, like, I used to have a little post-it on my computer that said, it's all about the emotion, right? So it's like the feelings in the scenes, what you're trying to evoke from the reader. And then when you go back, then it's where all the craft comes in, right? I have this lump of clay, now I'm going back, and now I'm building tension and making sure characters are consistent and the structure's consistent, and I'm doing line edits and, you know, the million things you do. I have like 20 editing iterations that I go through.
Well, without going into the, you know, spoilers and the twists and turns in the Uganda Protocol, that's all I had, because I was going to just make him tell what happens in the book next. You know,
we should just read the last pages of each book right now. That would be fun.
So that's really all I had, and I, you know, this was just amazing. You know, from the specifics about the series, the character, to craft generally, and your approach to craft, Jeff. Thank you for this. This has been amazing. You know, please, you know, let's hear it for.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
You can stand if you want.
Chris, I always love talking to you. And Chris's work is really fantastic, by the way. If you haven't read his work, please do. It's really terrific.
Thank you so much.
And I think we sold some of Alana Berry's books today, too.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah. She'd like that. Yeah, she's off into the wilderness. You know, a place where there's no traffic, and we're in the place where there is traffic. So thank you again, Jeff.
I do have my books here for sale.
Yes,
and I'm signing.
I was about to say,
so
yes, definitely.
Thank you. And if you like the books, please leave me a review on Amazon. I'd really appreciate that. It makes a big difference. And do the same thing for Elaine's Literary Salon. Just follow us. Go to elainesliterarysalon.com. There's a newsletter. And this Elaine's Writers Club, this new thing we're doing. And it's really just a way to help writers and bring them together as part of a really kind of elite community. People who just love story together. We're going to start doing some write-ins and doing some fun stuff here. So come join our club.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.